Well, let's go ahead and get going. And as I said yesterday, we looked yesterday at some of the things we see in the New Testament that directly or indirectly points at issues and themes with the Roman Empire. And I said that what we were going to do more today was be moving more towards the local and personal in talking about this. So that's our intention today. Why don't we go ahead, though, and pray first, all right? Father in heaven, we are grateful for this week that we have, and to be here and to take in the classes that we get to attend, and to see old friends, and to be encouraged and built up in fellowship and in worship. And Father, we want to, with our lives and the words that we speak, declare that Jesus Christ is Lord. So I pray that in the things that we talk about today, that we would be moved to think how we can do that more and more, and that your Spirit would be at work in us towards that end. And we pray in Jesus. Amen.
Amen.
So I did not get to attend the 3 o'clock session, but did Stanley Hauerwas talk about political things? Did he? Yeah, okay, all right. I mean, I'm not surprised. He
defined American Protestantism as dead.
Okay.
Okay,
well, he didn't do that in the first session either today. But so I'm going to look at a New Testament passage in a moment here, but I want to start with a thought experiment. And it has to do with the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki toward the end of World War II. And that's still something that is debated today about whether or not that was a moral thing to do. And one of the most prevalent arguments, I think the most dominant argument to say that that was moral, is just that at a practical level, it saved lives. Because the scenario was that we were looking at an invasion of the Japanese mainland to force the Japanese to surrender. And the consequences of doing that, it was going to cost a lot of American lives if we had to make that choice. But also, we saved Japanese lives in dropping the bomb. Because you know, there would have been many Japanese soldiers that died. If there was an invasion of the mainland, there would have been many civilian casualties. And in fact, it was a pretty reasonable expectation, it seems, that many Japanese civilians would have actually joined in the fight because, you know, their sense of honor about their homeland. Okay, so there was a sense of expediency in doing this. Okay, so the thought experiment is not to debate that whole issue, but to turn that around. What would be the conditions where it would be morally right for an enemy of the United States to use a weapon of mass destruction against an American city? When would that be morally okay? If the enemy nation decided that it was an expedient way to bring a war to conclusion, would it be okay then? If an enemy nation decided that America posed an imminent threat to their national security, would it be okay? We may not like it, but could we say that's morally justifiable? Or perhaps, if they saw in America just an insidious evil that was dangerous to the world. And so the problem that I'm posing here is, if you have an action that is okay when we do it to someone else, but it can never be okay to be done to us, we've got a little bit of a problem. And you know, somebody who is better versed than me in foreign policy would say that the problem I'm posing doesn't reflect the reality of nations at all, because nations take care of their self-interest. That's what they're there for. So we would be offended if somebody was hacking the phone of our president, but we kind of take it for granted that that's what nations do to each other in this modern environment. So I want to relate this to Rome now. Okay, come back to the Roman Empire. Roman thinking was pretty clear. And that was that when you think about the Jewish provinces or districts of Judea and Galilee in the first century, the Jews did not want Rome to be there. That's pretty apparent. In Roman thinking, it was okay to use violence against the Jews, at least sometimes. And it's not that they thought it was always okay, because they certainly thought that there were some governors that weren't very good governors, and they resorted to violence too quickly. And they were conscious of that, and they punished those governors. But they thought that there were situations where it could be okay. But it was never okay for the Jews to use violence against Rome. And why not? Because in Roman thinking, Rome acted not for their self-interest, they acted for the general welfare. You know, they're acting for the good of everybody. And so if you oppose Rome, you oppose the general good. And that implies evil, that your actions are evil. Okay, and so that's one way of getting at one of the problems of empire and the mentality of empire. Some people may say it in very simple terms, might makes right. I'm going to say it is the supremacy of power that creates the illusion of the supremacy of morality. Okay, it is the supremacy of power that creates the illusion of the supremacy of morality. And really, in a number of things that I want to do today, I want us to think about issues of power. Okay, so the passage that I'm going to be looking at today is in Colossians chapter 1. Colossians chapter 1. May you be made strong with all the strength that comes from His glorious power, and may you be prepared to endure everything with patience, while joyfully giving thanks to the Father, who has enabled you to share in the inheritance of the saints in the light. He has rescued us from the power of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of His beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. Okay, and so look at what's highlighted there in verse 13. Rescued us from the power of darkness, transferred us into the kingdom. And what does that harken back to when we think about Old Testament stories? The number one rescue story in the Old Testament is Exodus. Yeah, the Exodus story. God rescues the people out of this situation of darkness in the time of the Israelites, and then transferred us into the kingdom. God takes the people from Egypt and moves them into their own land, you know, land that becomes a kingdom eventually. Okay, so there's rescue, and then there is transfer into the kingdom. And so when you go back to verse 12, the mention of inheritance, there's a key word for Israel in thinking about its faith, because inheritance is used so often for talking about the land. The land is an inheritance from God. Okay? And that's the understanding generation after generation that way. So all of that, evoking the Exodus story, it takes us back to this oppressive ruler, Pharaoh in Egypt. And what are the Colossians going to think about when they think about this story? You know, how do they relate it to their time? Well, they could very easily think about Caesar, who is, you know, this dominator in their day. Okay, so let's keep going. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. We're talking about Christ here. For in him all things in heaven and on earth were created, things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers. All things have been created through him and for him. He himself is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And beginning at verse 15, that's where at least some scholars believe you have the beginning of an early Christian hymn that is being quoted there. All right. So the image of the invisible God in Roman times and the emerging Roman thinking that started to begin with Augustus Caesar and the Caesars after him, who is the image of a god? Well, that's Caesar. That would come to be the understanding. For in him all things in heaven and on earth were created. And with that statement there, okay, all things were created in Jesus Christ. So that's going to include Caesar, because it goes on to say whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers. Not just talking about earthly powers there, but all kinds of powers. That's going to include Caesar. And so what's happened in that statement is that it has taken Caesar from his lofty position and relativized him, okay, made him much smaller in relationship to Jesus Christ. And then even in verse 17, the highlighted phrase there, in Jesus Christ all things hold together. That was actually an understanding about Caesar. That is, that the whole empire and the stability and the structure and the prosperity, everything good is held together in Caesar. You know, he's the one who's holding this big thing and preventing it from collapsing. All right, let's keep going. One more slide here. Jesus Christ is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he might come to have first place in everything. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. And through him God was pleased to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, by making peace through the blood of his cross. Okay, so that Jesus Christ might come to have first place in everything. Again, Roman thinking is person who's first in everything is Caesar. And here that's being turned to Jesus Christ. Again, all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. In Roman thinking, again, that takes us back to what we just said earlier. That is that divinity or godness, you know, if you're going to find one figure on earth where that resides, that's going to be Caesar, whoever the Caesar of the day is. And then even that last word, you know, by making peace. The great achievement of the Romans was that they made peace. So, question is, how do we take that? Someone might say, no, you have that all wrong. All that stuff is talking about religious and spiritual things. It does not have to do with political things. Another take could be that it's really political protest against Caesar and Rome, but it's kind of dressed up in spiritual clothing. So, for an example for that, Arthur Miller, the playwright, who's probably most famous for Death of a Salesman, he wrote a play called The Crucible that is about the Salem witch trials. And in the Salem witch trials, you have these women who are charged with witchcraft, and if they agree to the charges, well, then they're in deep trouble. And if they deny the charges, well, then they're in deep trouble, because it just proves that they're witches, because of course witches would deny that they're witches. You know, so they can't win either way. And the Crucible, the story is about witches on trial in Salem, but it's not about the Salem witch trials. What was it about? Anybody know? 1950s? McCarthyism, yeah. You had these people who, if they said that they'd gone to communist meetings, well, then they're in deep trouble. And if they deny it, well, then you have this cloud of suspicion that's cast over them, like, you know, they're faking or whatever. And Arthur Miller just felt this was incredibly unfair to these people. And so he's using this story about Salem witch trials really to talk about something very different. And so that's one idea with this passage, is, again, that it's imperial protest, but it's dressed up in this religious and spiritual language. But I'm skeptical about that, because I think that there are too many connections in the language and what it evokes, the ways that it might point to Caesar. And yet, even as I say that, I don't believe that the main concern of the passage is Caesar and Rome. But again, like we talked about yesterday, that there is this great borrowing of Roman language to talk about Jesus Christ and what he is about. But what inevitably happens in that is that Caesar is diminished in respect to Jesus Christ and what his ministry is about and what Jesus is intended to accomplish. Jesus, to go back to what we said yesterday, that ultimately the battle that is being fought is so much bigger than the level at which Caesar is thinking about rule and domination. The battle is a battle that ultimately encompasses great spiritual forces, and it is Christ versus Satan. And Caesar is certainly part of that battle, like all of us are. But he is not the main opponent. But all of this language, I mean, what this is really, you know, intended to get to in Colossians for the Christians who are receiving this letter is, you know, that it's pointing them to a different way of being in the world. You know, who they are and what their identity is and how they think about themselves. Rome gets things done quite impressively, you know, lots of pageantry, you know, lots of raw power sometimes. And God gets things done by the cross. And that is just two different modes of existence in the world. Two different ways of living and thinking about who we are as people. For the people of God, they think about their lives in the world by the standard of the cross and how the cross accomplishes things. Okay, so let's think for a little bit about then more daily life in the Roman Empire. In Roman society, you have a social system that is based upon power relationships. And power relationships in the sense that, you know, it's typically two people and one person is up and one person is down. And the person who is up is called a patron and the person who is down is called a client. And this whole system and way of being, it just pervades Greco-Roman society in the first century. And so let's say that we have a humble shopkeeper. Okay, and the humble shopkeeper is the client. And there is a wealthy merchant who is his patron. And the shopkeeper will go to the patron in the morning and find out, is there anything that he needs done? Errands run, or is there some favor that he can do, something to help him out? And this merchant will say, "Why, yes, I need this done," or whatever, and so he does it. And the shopkeeper can also benefit the merchant by, in public festivities, there are different ways that he can show honor to the merchant by esteeming him. This is a valued citizen in our city and we need to recognize him. And there are different ways that he could do that. And then the merchant can benefit the shopkeeper because he patronizes his shop and purchases from him. And he can send other business his way. Maybe some other clients that he has, he can direct them to go to this shop. And so in this relationship, it's mutually beneficial. You know, both of them see that this has a value for them. But our merchant is also a client of another patron. And so maybe it is an official in the city, or perhaps it's the head of an aristocratic family. And so it's somebody who's more powerful than him, has more status or more wealth. And then it keeps on going up. That person is going to be a client of somebody else, so that eventually, at the very top, you have the patron who is head over all the patrons, and that is Caesar. He is the top patron in the empire, and his key officials are his clients, and he looks after their welfare, and they obviously help him out. And then it just spreads on down from there, down to the lowest levels and the farthest places of the empire. Okay, it works like that. But it means that people are always looking for clients and patrons who can help them out. People who can advance their social status, bring them wealth, enhance their prestige. And, you know, what we see is that everybody has to negotiate these relationships of power. It's driving everything. They're always having to work this system. It is all about power and figuring out how to work the power. Which, you know, maybe a slight parallel to today. Some things I've heard recently where they're talking to people about career advancement and telling people, you know, you need to think of yourself as a brand, and how do you enhance your brand and develop your brand? You need to be always working on your brand, you know, something like that. Now, one of the things for us is that I think a lot of times we'd like to see how this would actually play out when you bring Christianity into this mix in the first century. And there's a biblical scholar named Bruce Longenecker who takes a stab at it. And he writes a book called The Lost Letters of Pergamum. The Lost Letters of Pergamum, the city that's mentioned in Revelation. And it's not your typical work of biblical scholarship because it's fictional. And it's done in the form of these letters that are written back and forth between a man named Antipas and the gospel writer Luke. Okay, and so it's fictionalized, and he's trying to give a sense of what kind of impact would Christianity make in the society of the time. And so early on, the character Antipas, he goes to this one gathering where they talk about Christianity, but it's really more of an intellectual discussion. And then he goes to another gathering, and what you get the sense of is these are people who are really interested in forming their life around Jesus Christ. And so he goes in, and he is deeply offended by what he finds there. He sees that everybody values and tries to show respect to everybody else there, which is okay, except that Antipas is a man of status in the city, and he's not shown any more respect than anybody else. I mean, the kind of respect that is shown him, that's appropriate for him, is also shown to other people, and that bothers him. And so the book is talking about his evolution and his coming to understand Christianity. But what it shows there is that the church is not going to be about power relationships in that time. You know, that is so normal for people out there is not going to define us. You know, that's what the Christians are showing. And so part of the point that I make with something like this is that when we talk about Roman Empire, it's not just these big, grandiose, theoretical ideas about the world, but it's something that really affects people in their daily lives. You know, how they relate to the world around them and the way that they think about their relationships. The witness of the church in those early centuries, you know, as they're welcoming each other and welcoming people even at the lowest ends of society, they're not just showing that Christians are nice. I mean, they may be showing that, but they're not just showing that. They're showing that they think of power in different terms than other people. Okay, so let's switch this then to us now. And let's say that like a few years ago, we have an earthquake in Haiti. And on the news, we see devastating pictures. And there are children crying because they've lost their parents. And there are people out on the streets who don't have food and they're homeless. And so we get this wave in the U.S. of people donating to the Red Cross. And whatever I say, understand, I think that that is a terrific, good thing. And I'm glad that people do that. But one of the things that can happen with that is that it can reinforce identity at two levels. Okay, one is at a national level, that we are a nation that helps the world. And it's just a reminder of our fundamental goodness in the world. And the other one is, at an individual level, is that when I give my money, however much it is, it shows that I am a compassionate person. Okay, my gift tells me what kind of person I am. And this is not just me saying this, by the way. There's some really interesting studies over the last 10 years about what charitable giving, what it reinforces as far as identity with people. But just, you know, a basic observation for us is that typically when we do something like that, it comes out of a position of power, economic power on our part, and a position of luxury, in the sense that typically when we give to something like that, we don't have to alter our lives to do that. Okay, we don't have to make the kind of sacrifices that mean that we've taken away major choices from ourselves in the future. I'm glad that Americans are so giving in situations like that. Now, and think of something else. Our church, in the last couple years, longer than that, we have been involved with a poor family who had come into our church, and their situation got harder and harder, where they, no one in the house was working, and we're trying to figure out how to help them. Eventually, they didn't have housing, they didn't have any transportation, and there's a number of kids in the family. And even though in recent years the father had worked, you know, several different jobs, you see many of the markers in their family of long-term poverty. And I know that there are people in this room who know what these kinds of situations are about in terms of trying to help families like this, in that it is hard, it is time-intensive. There are a lot of people in our church who have made big contributions and have tried to help them. And it's frustrating, you know, because the people don't make the decisions that you want them to make. And you look at some of the decisions that they're making and you say, why are you doing that? You are messing up your kids' future, for goodness sake. Go ahead and mess yourself up. Don't mess with your kids, though. And so one day, I needed to have a talk with the dad about some things. And so I said, why don't we go to coffee and we'll just talk there. And so we went to the coffee shop and I asked him some questions I had. And then for just a long time, we just talked about ourselves and our lives. And he and I grew up in very different situations. But we're telling stories about where we came from and funny stories from our lives and telling stories about our kids and the great and frustrating and fun things that they do. And so something happens there in that interaction. And it's good. I'm feeling something different. I know he is too. There's a different relationship emerging. And what it showed was just over time in our relationship, you know, it became dominated by the reality of power. And it is that in the situation, me and other people in the church have power, and he feels powerless. He's only in the situation of being able to receive. He and I, we don't really have a lot of similar interests. And what I would typically think of as making for good friendship, he doesn't necessarily have that for me. You know, what I would consider in a good potential friend. But still, you know, I kind of find that those considerations can go by the wayside. And the question, you know, for me, the question I think for all of us as Christians, is one that I heard a number of years ago that came back to me with that whole experience. And it's the question, do we have friendships with poor people? And so it's not just a question about do we minister to poor people? Do we have a clothing bank for poor people? Do we go serve in the soup kitchen or whatever? But do we have friendships with people who are poor? Being friends in its own way can be hard. And like I said, it may not give us the relationship benefits that we typically would expect in friendships. And I'll also mention, I mean, we say this, and then we can make out being friends with poor people is just another way to reinforce our own identity and turn it back to us. You know, I recognize that that can still be an issue. Talking about poor people, we had a woman who had a huge impact on our church. Her name was Jeannie. And last year, she died. She had COPD and died, and that was very hard on us. But she'd been a former drug addict. She was living in poverty. And for the people that had known her before, I mean, just to hear them talk about how her life was revolutionized by coming to Jesus Christ, it was a powerful thing. Because they said, you know, you see Jeannie as this happy, joyful Christian, but she was a nasty, mean, rip-your-guts-out kind of person. And so, I mean, what we saw with her, she was a tremendous presence among us and a teacher for us. But we have an elder who has the gift of being able to put his finger on some things, uncomfortable things that are running underneath the surface. And might I say, that's a great gift to have in one of your elders. If you can cultivate that some way, it's great. But what he said at one point was, he said, I fear... This was when Jeannie was alive. He said, I fear that we're using Jeannie as a mascot to give credit to ourselves. Because we have Jeannie, we can pat ourselves on the back. You know, where that says something about who we are as a church. Again, it's a whole reinforcing our identity thing. And the point that he's making was, it really takes a lot more on Jeannie's part to come and be a part of us than it does for us, because we can still maintain that position of power and how we approach her. You know, think about the story that Sam Barrington told this morning about, you know, the woman that he told couldn't help out with the babies. And you're seeing kind of dynamic there. Okay, but where that's overcome again is just by people being friends with Jeannie. Not just saying, yeah, you can be part of our church, but actually becoming friends and sharing life, letting her share life with us. And so the reason I'm talking about these kinds of things is because, again, our sense of goodness often and unfortunately operates out of the security of power. Whether that's national or whether that's personal. And you think about that. Threaten our national security, and let's see how long our spirit of generosity lasts towards you. But friendship with the poor at a personal level is a way of surrendering our sense of power. And it's a hands-on way of learning how to live absent of the power that we so often cling to. And in the session this morning with Howard Wass, I got to hear his first session this morning. I mean, he said something similar with, if you want to talk about a really important political practice, look at Jean Vanier, who's the founder of the LARCH communities, where they take care of the mentally disabled. And he says, you know, that is an important political way of being, because, you know, you're valuing people that our society doesn't have a way to give value to. Okay, so I'm saying something similar here, that in how we, you know, extend friendship to poor people can be a very important political practice for us as the church, you know, a part of our political witness. All right, well, there was one more thing that I was going to talk about, but I'm going to table it. I'll just mention really quickly, one of the things that was happening in the first century in the Roman Empire that Caesar Augustus started to try to deal with was you had this breakdown in family life, and it was a really negative perception of family life. Men were not very enamored with the idea of family life. A lot of negativity. And yet, as the church emerged, you're getting this real flourishing of family life in the church. And it had to do with a lot of issues, but mainly having to do with the fact that the church honored women. Honored women in different, like, practical ways. And there's evidence that young women had more, young women in the church had more choice in whom they married. They married later because Roman practice, they might get married as young as 12 years old, but in the church they'd marry later. And also, you can imagine women loved this one. You didn't have this double standard about chastity outside marriage. Okay, so in Roman life, women, you know, we expect you to stay proper and you know, sex only with your husband. Men, hey, do whatever you want. And in the church, they're holding both people to the same standard. Okay, and that really led toward a more positive environment or more positive culture of family in the church. And there's just some things to relate to today because, you know, there's a lot of indications that particularly young women, and I'm thinking of teenage and even into 20s, you know, young women today are, even after you know, feminism and the sexual revolution, there's a lot of powerlessness that they experience, you know. So we could draw connections there. There's more that I could talk about, you know, talk about the crucifixion of Jesus and the significance of that. You know, Jesus had over him the sign, King of the Jews. You know, and the Romans are saying, hey, if you want to act like a king, this is what we'll do to you. Okay, and so what do we draw from that? N.T. Wright, particularly in some of his stuff, he has some terrific things to draw from that. But with the last couple of minutes, any questions or comments? Anything that you want to...
It's striking what you're talking about with the power relationship. I've seen that in it always comes off as kind of a good attitude or a genuine attitude. People say, well, our church is really good. We help this person, or I'm right. glad that we get to help this family. And so it does come off as this, you know, we're this great entity and we get to serve, you know, we get to help this people. It's not always like a one-on-one on their level. It's a feeling of, you know, I'm benevolent, this is who we are. And so I get that mascot thing, I've seen that. And I know that I've struggled with that at times, like you're helping somebody and you have this special feeling of, but it makes a lot of sense that we kind of come with that from a backward approach rather than being on their level. We're still kind of standing above them, controlling how we help them.
And I assume that I'm going to, in different ways, I'll struggle with that my whole life. You know, overcoming that. I think it's just a tough thing for us.
But you also indicated in the form of developing a genuine friendship that diminishes the power aspect and makes it more equal.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. And so rather than just trying to make our compassionate ministries more humane, is actually work at the relationship level. Yeah.
Interesting thing that I've read on Corinthians, the conflict over the communion was the wealthy disregarding the poor.
Yeah.
But then in the contribution, Paul refused to accept any patronage from the Corinthian wealth, because he didn't want to kowtow to that.
Oh, yeah, you're talking towards the end of 2 Corinthians? Yeah, that there the Corinthians are offended because...
He wouldn't take their money.
Right, yeah. Yeah, he wanted their gift for the people in Judea, but not for support for him. And so they were offended by it. Right, which is a way of exercising power in the first century, is if we give money to you, you know, that reinforces our identity and gives us significance. And so they look down on Paul for not accepting it. Yeah, that's great. Okay. All right. Thank you very much for coming and for listening.